What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to another episode of AmericaTrendsPodcast.com. John Krofcik, of course, always by my side. I'm Larry Rifkin. Hey, John, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
You're looking good.
Well, you too. I'm very casual
today. You look like a hillbilly.
Well, John, did you have to blow the lead? I really want to start with some lyrics today. I love song lyrics. I really do. And I'll bet you remember this song. And we'll see whether you remember who actually sang it. But if I could be you, if you could be me, for just 1 hour, if we could find a way to get inside each other's mind.
I know this song.
You remember it?
Yeah.
Okay. If you could see through my eyes instead of your ego, I believe you'd be surprised to see that you've been blind. Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Now, these are the lines that I really love. Yeah, before you abuse, criticize, and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes.
Great song. I always thought that was Elvis, because it's not
well,
like
it was.
Elvis.
No, Elvis sang it, but Joe South,
right,
I think, made the hit out of it.
Right, I think the original hit, but even he has that kind of an Elvis sound to him, don't you think?
Yeah, Joe South. Well, Elvis is from South Tupelo. But walk a mile in my shoes. Let me just read that line again. Yeah, before you abuse, criticize, and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes. And I'm just wondering, John, if you feel we do that. I mean, there's a wonderful set of ads out for a CNN series and saying, you probably disown me, disavow me, you probably shun me because of one characteristic or another. Do you think we have a hard time, particularly in a time of individuality and self-expression, where we see somebody who's got a nose ring or a piercing or a tattoo? I mean, do we say that those external markers are beta blocks? We don't want to look anywhere beyond that. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I think they are. I think especially those nose ring. I mean, I don't know why. I just happened to zoom right in on that. I'm like, why would somebody do that? But no, you're right. I think we have our own things that, how do I put it? But we prejudge. I think we prejudge people.
Which really means prejudice.
Right, right. We really.
And then when we get to know some of these people, if we get beyond those external markers, the dress, the hair, the color of the skin, weight, whatever it may be.
You find out that they're not what you thought when you first came in. You're absolutely right.
So how judgmental are we in the most callous and superficial way? I think that's one of the questions we're going to try to answer today as we look at a different culture. And, John, today we are going to be digging into one of the best-selling books of the entire year with a guy by the name of J.D. Vance. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for, just a remarkable period of time. And if someone tells you that their family, for example, John, comes from the Ozarks or Appalachia, does that not give you a marker that's hard in some way to overcome?
Well, I think, you know, I think with television always stereotype. So I think television has helped us with the different TV shows. Think of these people as that way. You know, they're the hillbillies or they're, you know, and unfortunately, that's what's happened.
Yeah, it does. And J.D. Vance is not disavowing us that there's a lot to the hillbilly culture that he needed to help overcome in his own life in order to be successful. I mean, there's a lot about the hillbilly culture, as he calls it, that really talks about class and talks about social status, but also talks about a lot of drug abuse and a lot of abuse in terms of spousal abuse and the like. And there are many things in his own life that he looks back on and is pretty amazed that he was able to overcome some of that to go to Yale and to really accomplish all the things that he has. But he's written this book, Hillbilly Elegy. And it really is a beautiful story, so, you know, elegantly portrayed in terms of this analysis of a culture that is in crisis. And we may not think of this lower white middle class or lower class white culture in some of this middle American area and think about it a lot. I mean, maybe we just don't give it a lot of attention, but there are so many people who do fall into that category.
Yeah, well, especially with the news on the illegal immigrants and the plight of immigrants, I think a lot of America has gotten lost, and I believe that to be true. I think we've forgotten about those people that live under those conditions and, you know, what's going on there.
And it's true, because a lot of what we see in the media really portrays a picture of urban America on the West Coast or the East Coast. So we know a lot about New York. I mean, how many shows have we seen or movies that are all based in New York or even in California? But this group, and he talks about the legacy of abuse and alcohol, poverty, trauma, that is characteristic of this part of America. And he does want us to have some greater understanding. I mean, for many of us, the only representation we saw of a hillbilly, if you will, was the Beverly Hillbillies when we were growing up, right?
Yeah, they hit it big.
Yeah. First thing you know, Jed's a millionaire. The kid folks said, Jed, move away from there. No, but seriously, we just don't understand this culture. And, of course, we popularize the dissonance between sophistication and culture and the backwoods in that series. But this is a much more textured response to what's been going on. Well, the Beverly Hillbillies have been off the air for a long time, right? Thankfully, I think.
Still probably running in reruns somewhere.
I'm sure. But this book, just one book, has awakened the nation to the challenges that they are facing. Written by a guy who did break through. In his memoir, J.D. Vance describes the pain involved. And since it's such a big book and it's really gotten the attention of America, we are so glad to have him on today on AmericaTrendsPodcast.com. Right, John?
Yeah, let's get him on here.
All right. J.D. Vance, congratulations on just the impact that your book is having. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
So explain to people what it was, I mean, you having left, in a sense, to go to Yale Law School right here in Connecticut and leaving what you consider to be the hillbilly culture. Explain what that is, first of all.
Well, I think the hillbilly culture is characteristic of the place where I grew up, and it's a place where it's pretty hard scrabble. People don't make a lot of money. People tend to work in these industries and these jobs that are harder and harder to come by. But it's also a place where people are very loyal to each other, where people expect that a lot of their kids are going to stay in the place where they grew up, that they're not going to go off and necessarily go to school and live the upwardly mobile life as a lot of Americans consider it. But it's also this place, I think, of intense patriotism and love and beauty. And so I think all of these things combine into a sometimes combustible, sometimes great mixture. And I think that mixture is at least part of what we're seeing in a lot of the Donald Trump movement these days.
And, of course, there are many social scientists, including Charles Murray, who has been on this program, and they have been studying, this issue. A lot of working-class white individuals, a lot of men, dislocated, joblessness, divorce, addiction. Is that what the hillbilly culture now, evidences? Is there a lot of that going on, and why?
Well, there's certainly a lot of that going on, and if you look at the statistics, working-class white youth are now the most likely group to die of heroin overdoses, more than the youth of other races and other classes. So there are increasing rates of family dissolution and breakdown, rising rates of divorce, and it creates this sense, I think, of a real community in crisis, as I write about in the book. So there's definitely something there that has to be understood. I mean, I think it has its roots both in the culture of these places, the communities, and the intergenerational traits that they've inherited. But I also do think it has some roots in the fact that the places where these people live it's harder and harder to find a decent job, a job you're proud of, a job that pays a good wage. So I think it's complicated, but it's certainly a place that's struggling.
And if it is hollowed out, again, I guess I wonder about whether a lot of it is as the result of internal forces or external forces. And do people see help on the way? Do they see help in the form of Donald Trump? Because this article today in the New York Post said if you get outside of certain areas of Pennsylvania or Ohio, all you see are Donald Trump signs everywhere. Is that what they're hoping for, looking for? Even though the last couple of days he's been talking more to urban America.
Yeah, well, what I think is that people are very frustrated, and I see that as more of the source of the Donald Trump phenomenon than any hope that he's going to create or enable a significantly better life. A lot of the people that I talk to back home are very realistic about Donald Trump. They're supporting him, but they also recognize that he doesn't have all the answers to all of their problems. And so it's more almost a negative reason they're voting for Donald Trump. I think they feel culturally alienated from Hillary Clinton. They feel culturally alienated from the elites of both the Republican and Democratic parties. But they're very hard-nosed and realistic about what Trump can and can't do. And I think what he can do is raise some of the same objections that they feel towards the elites. But what he can't do is fix a lot of the problems they're seeing in their communities.
And how much a rarity are you? I mean, somebody who beat the odds. I mean, you left the culture, though you had a hard time, you say, adjusting, of course, at Yale to some of the social conventions that you were never taught, you know, where you lived and how you grew up. And you work at an investment firm now in Silicon Valley. I mean, a total departure, but you had to beat the odds. What were the odds that you had to overcome?
It's a combination of things. One, it's a sense of learned helplessness from the community around me. So one of the things I grew up believing is that people who made it were just really smart or really lucky. It didn't really enter my calculation that there were maybe folks who were reasonably intelligent but just worked really hard. And I think that creates a sense that your choices don't matter. One of the barriers I faced is that I grew up in a family that was very chaotic and violent. It was hard to get time to study at home, hard to feel safe and stable. And that, of course, produces not just difficulties with studying and doing well in school, but that family violence and chaos also, you know, produces increased rates of incarceration and increased likelihood of drug use and so on down the line. So there were a lot of these traits that were very common in my neighborhood and in my family that if you read the statistics or if you just understand my own life, you'll recognize they make it very hard for kids like me to get out. And because of that, like you said, stories like mine are not that common. And I think that's a real problem in a country like ours where we really value this American dream, this idea that folks from any background can make it.
Did you think you were different?
Well, when I was growing up, I didn't think that I was really different at all. I felt very much a part of my community and a part of the place that I grew up in, and I still really do. I think even though I've lived a life that's very blessed and very lucky, I still fundamentally feel most home when I'm in Southern Ohio, when I'm in Eastern Kentucky, which is kind of my ancestral homeland. But I will say that I did feel out of place when I got to a place like Yale, and I think to understand why is to understand that a lot of the lessons that I learned growing up weren't necessarily conducive to succeeding in a social environment and an environment of extreme wealth and privilege like the one that I experienced at Yale and, frankly, the one I've continued to experience, because it's not just the educational institutions that are somewhat disconnected from the place that I grew up, but it's a lot of other institutions too. It's a lot of these fancy law firms and investment firms and so forth. So I do think that disconnect, that feeling of being a bit of an oddity, is a big part of my story and frankly a big part of why there aren't more kids like me in the country these days.
And how close were you to remaining part of the hillbilly lifestyle if it were not for your grandparents, who themselves had a lot of issues, but then began to overcome them and really try to nurture you? We hear about kind of lost generations of parenting in the urban areas where grandparents are really stepping in. Tell us what it's like in these rural enclaves.
Yeah, well, my grandparents, as I write in the book, were really the best things that ever happened to me. And even though they were, you know, I think very flawed people and didn't necessarily do great by my mother, who I write about in the book, when she failed and when she got a taste for narcotics, it was my grandparents who really stepped up and ensured I had an opportunity at a good life. So you asked me how close I was to not making it. And the answer is very close. I nearly failed out of high school in my freshman year. I started to do drugs early in high school. I was a very resentful kid. I really thought that in some ways the deck was stacked against me. And it was my grandparents, especially my grandma, who made sure that I, one, believed that I had some capacity to control my own fate, and two, really gave me the safety and the stable home that was needed to make some better decisions for myself and ensure I didn't fall prey to my community's worst habits.
And as you talk around the country today, I mean, when we think about the hillbilly lifestyle, we think about Appalachia and Kentucky and portions of West Virginia, Ohio. I mean, how, you know, extensive is the, you know, the culture that we're talking about here? I mean, is it all of rural America? Explain to us what you're trying to define.
Yeah, I think there's always a danger in being too reductionist about this sort of thing. So I don't think that it's all of rural America. What I will say is that a very significant chunk of the white working class, maybe even the majority of the white working class, has some connection to what I'm calling hillbilly or Scots-Irish culture, whether it's a grandparent who came from these areas, you know, whether it's a parent who immigrated from West Virginia to Indiana or Illinois for better work. There is an incredible cultural homogeny in a lot of these areas. It's not perfect. It's not everyone. But there is a significant chunk of the Rust Belt, of the South, and of Appalachia that really shares a lot of cultural traits in common. They think very similarly about a lot of the problems facing the country. And, of course, if you look at the data, they vote very similarly in their political choices.
And what do they think about the elites that now control America, you know, an elite that you're part of now in Silicon Valley? What do they think of those elites?
Well, I think that two things. One, they don't think those elites care very much about people like them. They don't think that the elites really understand the struggles that they're going through and are trying to fix them or even show compassion towards them. And I think second, and this is really important, they feel very looked down on by the elites. My grandma once said that hillbillies were the one group of people that it was okay for people to look down on in this country. You couldn't look down on anybody else, but you could look down on hillbillies. And there is this sense, I think it's overblown, but I also think it is true, that the elites don't necessarily check their offensive attitudes when it comes to rural America. They don't feel that ashamed that they're looking down on their countrymen as racists or rednecks or white trash. I think that's a really unfortunate part of kind of modern American culture. But I will say this, that a lot of these things stem mostly from the fact that people don't know each other. A lot of people who live in New York, D.C., they've never been to West Virginia. They've never been to Southern Ohio and vice versa. And so that disconnect and that unfamiliarity, I think, breeds a lot of mistrust. When in reality, you know, as I've learned in my life, the gross majority of the white working class and the gross majority of what I'll call the elites are ultimately good people who just want the best for themselves and their country.
Well, as someone who has seen it from both angles, and you going to Yale, what was it that you think those at Yale did not understand about your life in, you know, say, a countrified situation and about the people that you grew up with? What's the biggest misunderstanding? And you could kind of go either way.
Yeah, that's a tough question to answer because I think there are a lot of misunderstandings. But the big misunderstanding that comes to mind is that folks just didn't appreciate that when you grew up lower income, and I wouldn't confine this just to rural America or to somebody who grew up in a Rust Belt town like me. I'd frankly say this is true, that there was a little bit of a blind spot with respect to all lower-income Americans, whether they were black, white, Hispanic, or whatever, that there was a sense that we didn't know how to conduct ourselves. We didn't know what it meant to sit in a fancy firm dinner and to network. We didn't know what was required to get ahead. We didn't know what was required to learn through these informal networks what jobs were right for us or how to access the people who could give you those jobs. And there was a real sense of among the lower income folks at Yale that we didn't necessarily know a lot of the secrets. And I think that the upper income folks, the people who really are the gatekeepers to a lot of these institutions, would do well to recognize that it's not just the direct economic barriers to getting to a place like Yale that are important, though those things certainly are important. It's a lot of times the social and the cultural barriers that when you get to a place like that, you just don't know really how to conduct yourself. or how to make the right choices in an environment that's very strange to you.
Do they feel, in a sense, there's this article today in the New York Post by Selena Zito talking about Pennsylvania, and she's talking about some of the same people that we're talking about, and she said 30 years ago, such people determined the country's standards in entertainment, music, food, clothing, politics. They are the people who are accused of creating every social injustice imaginable. When anything in society fails, they get blamed. I mean, are these people who feel that the country has moved away from them, or that people have just given up on them or forgotten about them? I mean, what is it that they're feeling about the cultural drift that has occurred in America, say, over the last 20 to 30 years?
Well, it's all the above, probably, right? It's the sense that a lot of their attitudes and a lot of their views are out of fashion. It's the sense that the folks who have political power, and these people certainly don't feel like they have political power, they often feel that the people with political power look down on them and judge a lot of their habits and a lot of their behaviors. So it's a combination of factors, but I think what is at the root of all of it is really this sense that the future is not going to be better than the past. These areas where these folks live, it's again, not just the economic deprivation, it's the drugs, it's the family breakdown, it's the rising incarceration rates. People are justifiably very pessimistic about the future, and I think they don't believe that many elites care about that very worrisome future that they see in front of them. I mean, it's kind of striking if you think about the optimism, the very admirable optimism in some ways of the Democratic National Convention, and you juxtapose it against these people who really feel like the world around them is falling apart. Like every time they open up the newspaper, they see the obituary of a new kid, a new 22-year-old kid who's died of a heroin overdose. It's really, I think, that difference between a lot of elites feel like the world is getting better, and a lot of people where I grew up feel like the world is getting worse.
Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. And when you say in the book that the problem faced by the white working class, but I know it starts, you don't quite know exactly, what the answer is precisely, but I know it starts when we stop blaming Obama or Bush or faceless companies and ask ourselves what we can do to make things better. Given a world where everything is kind of magnified and everything is becoming big this and big pharma and big medicine and everything else, is it really getting harder to climb those mountains and to, look and say, I can make it on my own, given, so many of the structures that seem so remote from me?
The data definitely suggests, and I think it's important to point out here, that it is harder to climb those mountains. It is harder to get ahead economically when you're a poor American. I think that's been true probably for two or three decades. The economic data suggests upward mobility sort of peaked in the 50s and 60s and fell off in the 70s and hasn't done a lot better since then. So there is a very real and true way in which it's harder to get ahead in the United States. But it's also true that people still have the capacity to control some of their own destiny and some of their own fate. And I think that why I wrote the book ultimately is I want people to recognize both the very legitimate economic barriers that folks face, but I also want my own people, my own white working class family and neighborhood and community to appreciate that there are still things that we can do to control our own fate, that we need to be a little bit more connected and engaged in our communities, that we can't blame politics, we can't blame Obama, we can't blame other people for everything. We have to be a little bit introspective because, the Trump thing is a perfect representative of it. I think this failure to think very seriously about what ails our community has led to Donald Trump, because I do think that there are probably political and policy solutions, or at least policy things that would help our community, but we're not even really talking about them because we're so frustrated and we're so angry that even in our political conversation, we're not talking about a lot of what really ails our community. And so I think that's got to change, and I think that government can do better, but I also think we can do better, and both sides of that equation have to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, when you say there was something almost spiritual about the cynicism of the community at large, including believing that the media lies, that the military is fighting, fruitless wars, the universities feel rigged and inaccessible, job prospects are slim, You know, again, I can see where, you know, the messages that have been coming about a rigged election and the media and so forth are really resonating. I mean, I can really understand that. Well, I hope that this book can help us to at least begin to understand some of the problems in rural America. And I think many of us focus on urban America. But, you know, this is such an important book and has gotten the requisite amount of attention because it's so well written. Thank you so much, J.D. Vance. Hillbilly Elegy. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. If you like this episode of America Trends Podcast, will you please leave us a kind rating or a review on iTunes? John, is that too much to ask?
No, or even a comment. Give Anything. Us in the comment section on the ones that you liked. And, you know, you can also email me at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. And that's another way you can contact us with your ideas.
Don't forget, your review really is important to us. And, John, they may say, why? Why is it so important? Well, the more
why?
You...
Tell us.
You're even asking
why?
That.
Why?
Well, the more you like us, the better placement we get, which then helps us improve our rankings and visibility so that more people can enjoy us. And the more people, John, you see how this is spiraling?
It's getting out of control.
The more people who know about us and like our content, the greater chance we have to encourage advertisers to hop aboard. You see how it works now, John?
I understand now. That's very interesting.
And we don't want these folks who are listening to miss a single episode of America Trends Podcast. I mean, we're recording tons of them, aren't we?
No, and they're all very interesting, and we've got some really good stuff coming up.
Oh, we really do. But we want you to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com. And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms is @TrendsPodcast. We want to thank you personally for subscribing. In fact, John may have a very beautiful thank you gift. John, what is it? No? Ran out of them?
All out of gifts.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
sorry about that.
Please send us your ideas and questions for future episodes and topics on America Trends Podcast. We can't think of them all, right, John?
That's right.
I mean, my head's already exploding.
Oh, yes.
You see it?
I
cloud
see it.
Above. Is there an author you'd love to hear from? Or a subject you'd like to learn more about, send us your ideas on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or use #TrendsPodcast. You can also add an email address if you have one that you want to give out. And we do not, right, John? We don't share our lists.
No spamming, no list getting out. You just get our newsletter.
Absolutely. And you can access our full show archive on our website at americatrendspodcast.com. For more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on our upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. Oh, by the way, and John, this is really important, and you know.
What is it? What is it?
Well, if you buy from Amazon, we have joined their associates program. So you go to americatrendspodcast.com before you purchase, and you click over to Amazon from our Amazon store.
That's a very good point, because it doesn't cost them any more money to do that.
No, that's all built in.
And then we get a few pesos.
Yeah, but
keep the podcast going.
You know, if we get a small VIG, you know, 2 or 3%, if you don't do it through us, you're just giving more money to Jeff Bezos.
Exactly.
And he doesn't need any more money.
He doesn't need it. That's
and he doesn't
correct.
Do any podcasts, I don't think. So please, with no added cost to you, it helps us to bring you the content that you're enjoying. And thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Please keep listening.